Captain Featherstone, Delk Reel 5. We're talking about your time standing by HMS Rio at Boston. Started around about December 1943. What about the armament of the ship? Because starting with a 3-inch gun, I think, because that's an unusual gun in itself.
Well, it was unusual for the Royal Navy, yes. We had three-inch guns, two forward and one aft. And we had a Bofors, it's a 40-millimeter, I think a twin-barreled Bofors, and a number of 20-millimeter Oerlikons.
Now, what did the 3-inch in particular? I mean, there's been a lot of criticism of the 3-inch gun as a gun. What did you think of it? I mean, I know you were the first lieutenant, not the gunnery officer.
Well, from the point of view of attacking a submarine, it was probably big enough to make a hole in the submarine. But it seemed to us a bit of a pop gun, I think, compared to what we'd been used to. The controls were fairly rudimentary. There was no director tower or anything like that. Pat, I can't remember quite how one did control the guns. But I don't think we ever fired them in anger. They went behind gun shields, and so when he was steaming into a head sea, they were got very badly soused with water. And there was a sort of breakwater around them on one occasion, on the forehead guns. And then on one occasion, we had very bad weather, and this surrounding for the gun was practically flattened by the sea.
So that was the 3-inch guns. What about the Bofors and the Oerlikon? What did you think of them?
Oh, they were fine. Good rate of fire. They didn't jam, and the sailors loved them. Yeah. Then we had depth charges and a hedgehog. So we were familiar with all those things.
What did you think of the absence of torpedoes? I mean, that was...
Well, we had torpedoes in Hurricane. One set of tubes was taken out, and we had an anti-aircraft gun put there instead. But we never fired our torpedoes. Although later on, the Admiralty introduced a thing called a Mark 10 depth charge, which was it weighed a ton. And you fired them out of the torpedo tubes. And that made one hell of a bang, a ton of explosive. And that was meant to really sort out the submarines. We never actually attacked one, I don't think, with the Mark 10 discharge. But we fired one to see what it was like.
Now, this Mark 10, that was on the Rio?
It was fired out of the torpedo tubes.
But they didn't have torpedo tubes on the Rio?
No, not in Rio. No, I'm talking about Hurricane. Yeah. No, we didn't have a Mark 10 thing in Rio, no. And it was a bit of a gimmick, I think. I don't believe there's any record of a submarine being sunk by the Mark 10 depth charge. It was a bit of a joke, I think. But it did make a noble bang when it went off, I can tell you.
Now, you were standing by. What about the speed of building, the construction method? Do you have any comments to make about the way they were built?
No, only the astonishing speed with which they were built. I've got my diary here of that period, and it shows that I went to a commissioning ceremony almost every week. It was astonishing the speed at which they built these things.
Now, you were standing by. What were your actual duties as First Lieutenant?
Well,
during the building period?
Well, each ship had an office in the shipyard. Where you dealt with any of the paperwork necessary. You checked out the stores which were going to be put on board, which there was a complete sort of inventory, and there was a warehouse in which every ship's stores were set out on the floor, this enormous warehouse. So you had to check that it was all there according to the list, and eventually decide where it had got to go in the ship, because they were very organized, the Americans. Every bit of equipment and spare and so forth had its own proper stowage and assigned position in the ship. Nothing was left to chance. And so although the ships weren't all that big, they were able to stow in an orderly fashion an astonishing amount of stuff.
So you were ashore. Now, what do you remember? And this was going on until the ship was commissioned.
Rather... You commissioned... And
do you remember the commissioning ceremony? When was it?
The commissioning ceremony would have been That's right, sort of over Christmas, or very early in 1944. And I wanted to make a bit of a splash about this, because it so happened that HMS Leander, a British cruiser, had been torpedoed in the Pacific and had been brought into Boston Navy Yard to be repaired. And the commander of the Leander was a 14th cousin of mine called Stephen Roskill, who wrote the History of the War at Sea. So I rang him up. I said, could you by any chance spare your Royal Marine Band? He said, yeah, sure. And so the Royal Marine Band came down, and they were on the jetty, sort of playing oompa oompa music, until suddenly there was this terrible hush. Their instruments had all frozen up. It was incredibly cold. I mean, there was snow on the ground. And there was a totally mute Royal Marines Band. I think it must be the first and last time in history. So that wasn't terribly successful. But I had Commander Stephen Roskill down and so forth, and all the knobs. And we had a sponsor for the ship, whose name I can't at the moment remember, but she was a very attractive American woman. And she, you know, proposed a toast to the ship and everything else, made a little speech. And there it was. My captain was a lieutenant commander called Michael Faining, F-A-N-I-N-G.
F?
F-A-N-I-N-G, Michael Faining, who was all right.
What was he like? Because, you know, how did you form a working relationship with him? You were his first lieutenant.
I was indeed, yeah. He was pleasant, a bit of an old cup of tea, but he was very pleasant. I never had any trouble with him, and he had no trouble with me. We got on all right, but he would never set the world on fire, I don't think.
Not the brightest.
Well, no, but
competent enough.
That's the word.
What about your other officers? Could you go through any others that you remember?
Do you know, I honestly can't. Except I, oh, dear. It's an awful long time ago. And I wasn't in there all that long. And so I didn't really, get to know them terribly well.
Now, when the ship was commissioned, when did you get your sea trials?
Oh, we went straight from commissioning. When you've done your storing and so forth, you went straight out and did the sea trials from Boston.
Could you explain just for them what sea trials are? What exactly you would do? What as first lieutenant you'd be looking for?
Well, you've got to shoot the guns off and make sure they work. Probably fire a full pattern of depth charges. The engineers have got to make sure that their engines work and the freshwater system works, and the facilities are there for fueling at sea. Doing everything or trying out everything which you'd need to do when the ship was in full commission.
Now, you wouldn't get very far into this before, because you were only with her 2 months, weren't you? You left her in January 44.
Well, thereby hangs a tale. There was an American banker whose name was Cherry, C-H-E-R-R-Y. And he and three others, I think, came over to England before America had entered the war, and joined up in the RNVR. And if you go to the Royal Naval College, Greenwich, you will find on the threshold of the painted hall there's a plate let into the floor which records the arrival in England of these four Americans, and it mentions them by name. Of course, they were doing an illegal thing, because the Americans hadn't joined in the war. And so they were virtually sort of hard assassins. Anyway, one of these, Cherry, had been appointed first lieutenant of HMS Braithwaite, which was one of the diesel DEs. And he'd had a very near mutiny on his hands in the Braithwaite, because he hadn't got a faintest idea how to run a ship, especially amongst all these limeys.
What was he doing wrong?
Well, you'd have to read his book, Yankee RN.
Yes, I just wondered about your perspective of it, because he gives a more...
Have you read Yankee RN?
I saw the extract, he doesn't seem to criticise himself too much.
Oh, dead right. Anyway, he did.
He making a pig's ear of it.
Absolute pig's ear. And so it was decreed that he should have a change. And there was a certain Commander Campbell out there, and he was sent to take over one of these DEs, and Cherry was sent as his first lieutenant. Sorry, Campbell was to take over Rio, that's right, and Cherry was sent to Rio to be his first lieutenant. And so I was shifted to stand by another ship, HMS Hudham. So back I went to Hingham. Cherry didn't do terribly well, but he just about got by with Campbell, who I think kicked him to death. But he was absolutely ignorant of affairs. Being a banker, he said, "No, I better invest the ship's funds in order to make it." I said, "You can't do that. This is public money." But he had no sort of conception of how things run.
So
he was a pleasant enough chap, but totally divorced from reality, as far as I'm concerned.
Now, so then you went back to
Hingham. I went back to Hingham and stood by the Hudham. Hotham.
Hudham, that's how you pronounce
Pronounced
it.
Hudham, yes.
And what happened there? When was she commissioned?
About the 10th of February, we commissioned.
Now, was she the same type?
She was identical. He was identical.
And
yes.
You were first lieutenant again.
And I was first lieutenant. And my captain was an R&R, lieutenant commander called Sidney Ailes, A-Y-L-E-S. Who?
What was he like?
He was fine. He'd been serving in the Royal Mail Steamship Company as a merchant ship officer, and he was lieutenant commander R&R, quiet, competent. Very nice, we got on extremely well, and I can't remember any upsets with him at all.
What would you say the role of first lieutenant was on a ship? If you just give us a little, you know.
To make sure that everything other than the engine room ran smoothly and to the captain's satisfaction. Discipline, cleanliness, organisation, general smartness. And efficient in everything that a ship's meant to be able to do.
Now,
he's the first captain to be kicked by the captain if anything goes wrong.
Fair enough. What do you remember about the sea trials on the Hudham?
We went back to Casco Bay up in Maine for our sort of initial sea trials, and then we went down, praise the Lord, to Bermuda, where the weather, of course, was absolutely super. And they had a training base down there, and they also had a tame submarine, which we used to do anti-submarine exercises.
What do you remember of those? I mean, what would a typical anti-submarine exercise be like off Bermuda?
Well, the submarine would be surfaced some way away, and you would give the order to the submarine to dive, and down she'd go. Perhaps 4 or 5 miles away, and you then have to pick her up on the ESDIC or the sonar, and carry out dummy attacks on her. If you wanted to know where she was or whether your attack had been successful, you could drop a hand grenade, which she'd hear, and she would fire up a smoke candle, as it's called, a sort of smoke float, showing exactly where she was. So you could. You could decide whether or not your attack would have been successful.
And how did the ship do? I mean, you had a new crew, or mostly new crew, I believe. Most of the captain class had fairly new crew.
Oh, sure, they did, yes. Well, you started off, it depended very much whether you had an intelligent lot or not. By and large, they were, because they'd all trained in England as anti-submarine ratings. And so you had to work the machine, the ESDIC. And provided the captain was cooperative and handled the ship in a way which suited them as well, that was fine. But, no, it was... it wasn't very advanced stuff. I mean, the submarine wasn't sort of going down enormously deep to try and shake you off. It was there really to make sure that your attack procedure was up to a reasonable standard of efficiency.
Any other special exercises or trials at Bermuda?
Yes, there was an air station down there, and they had used to send out an aircraft towing a drogue, a sort of sleeve drogue, so that you could fire off your Bofors and your Ehrlichans at this thing and try and hit it or bring the sleeve down. I can't remember doing any surface gunnery with our little 3-inch pop guns, but I suppose we did.
What about the abandoned ship exercise? Had they introduced that at the time?
Well, we didn't do that, no.
Some of them did. But
No, tempting fate, I think. Well, it wouldn't have been so bad doing that in Bermuda, where the water was quite warm, as opposed to somewhere up north.
So when did you leave? You left Bermuda around about March, I presume?
We sailed about the middle of April over to Norfolk, Virginia, where we found the British aircraft carrier HMS Indomitable, which had been repaired there after damage in the Mediterranean. And we and two other frigates escorted the Indom back to the UK. And then...
Anything about the trip?
No, we were by the Azores, where I think we fueled. And, of course, the Indom was flying aircraft, anti-submarine patrols and so forth. But no, uneventful.
Well, one thing you must by then have noticed, I mean, I don't know whether it would seem bad to you, they had a terrible reputation for rolling.
Oh, yes.
Now, was it you'd been on a lot of destroyers. How did it compare to the average British destroyer for rolling?
I'd say more. Worse. I think possibly because they had rather a lot of top weight somehow. And they were also somewhat narrower in the beam than the destroyers I'd been in. But they did. If you were a bad sailor, God help you. But I, of course, after whatever it was, a couple of years in the Atlantic, I was perfectly okay.
So you didn't care?
Didn't what I mean, no. But I don't think I remember the sailors throwing up in the scuppers all the time either. Of course, we'd all been at sea for quite a time, especially in small ships. And once you got used to it, a different sort of roll and pitch doesn't really affect you. But they were notorious for rolling badly.
Now, when you got back to the UK, where were you based?
Well, we went up to Belfast. And
would that be to Pollock Dock?
It was. Fancy you knowing that, yes. And we did more working up, really, to prepare us for D-Day.
Now, did you get a refit there? Because in a lot of the captain class, once they got into English hands or into English port, they immediately ripped half the American facilities out and put a lot more depth charges on. Now, did that happen to the Holland?
We did indeed put more depth charges on, but what was, so far as we were concerned and the sailors were concerned, we made some scuttles, put some scuttles in, portholes. And so for the first time, you could look out of the porthole when in the wardroom and see what the weather was like outside. And that was tremendous. Of course, you couldn't put portholes on the side, but at least the officers had some, and I think I had one in my cabin, too. It was all nice.
Now, what about the other things? What about the cafeteria? They took the cafeteria out in a lot of them.
No, we kept ours.
Laundry?
And we kept our laundry. In fact, I didn't remember us monkeying about very much.
Did you have the extra depth charges put on?
Yes, we did. Yes.
Because they put on a lot more.
They did. Which would make it roll even more. But...
Was it a big refit, or...?
Oh, it wasn't a refit so much. No, it was a certain amount of alterations and additions, shall we say.
Now, were you in an escort group? I'm not sure which escort group you were in.
We weren't, actually.
So what were you doing while you were refit? Well, having this sort of minor refit.
That's right, yeah.
Whatever you
Otherwise, we were working up again with the gunnery, anti-submarine, and anti-air. For example, they had. I remember on one occasion a Spitfire came streaking in from ahead, and it suddenly opened up with all its eight guns. Woof! About 50 yards on the ship's beam. And I'd never seen a Spitfire A that close, or B actually firing. It was as though you were firing at us. But by God, it scared the pants off us. We thought, cracky, if this happens to us in real life, we should be in dead trouble. I mean, even one burst from eight guns is quite something.
It was a concentration of the firepower.
A concentration of firepower. And an absolute woof in the water, you know. Anyway, we were finally inspected by the famous Monkey Stevenson, who ran this place at Tobermory, the sort of battle school there. And if you got through that all right, and underwent his inspection without too many hiccups, then you were reckoned to be fit for war, which is what we did. And so, having done that, we then went round to the Portsmouth area, where we did a few escorting jobs.
Escorting what?
Oh, my old ship, the Rodney, for example. What she was doing there, I can't remember. But we escorted her, I think, from Portsmouth down to Devonport. And we also did another...
Did you get the chance to get aboard her
again? No. We also carried out a number of anti-E-boat patrols.
Tell me about them.
Well, they were done mostly at night.
What would a typical one be like, start to finish?
Well, you'd lie stopped and listen for the noise of their engines.
Whereabouts were you? How far would you go into the...
Oh, perhaps 10 miles off the French coast, sort of thing. Or off the Dutch coast. We, in fact, never struck oil there. We never heard a thing. But that was the idea, to lie in wait until you heard the roar of their engines and then try and intercept them.
But nothing happened.
We drew a blank on that one. But it was rather boring.
Were you very aware of the D-Day preparations that were going on? That must have been going on.
Oh, Lord, yes. Yes, the build-up of ships in the in Spithead and the Solent was remarkable. In fact, when it finally came, we were sent to patrol 15 miles off Cape Barfleur, which is sort of where Cherbourg is, isn't it? On the night before D-Day, we watched all the aircraft going overhead with the paratroops and the gliders and everything else. I lost count at 400 of bombers and assault aircraft. And as soon as come the dawn, we screeched back to Portsmouth at high speed and picked up a convoy of, I think, four or five tank landing ships. And we took them across on the afternoon of D-Day and landed them off Allemanche on the invasion beaches. That was quite a sight because, you know, there were battleships and cruisers and destroyers all bombarding like billy-o, and the noise and everything else. It was fairly dramatic. There were more ships than one's ever seen. and the landing ships coming in as well. It looked absolute mayhem, but of course it worked marvelously due to immaculate planning. But it was quite a sight. It was quite something to be there on the day.
Did you come under fire yourselves, or...?
An aircraft... Yes, there was some shore battery which lobbed a few shells, but nowhere near us, luckily. And I think there were one or two rather desultory air attacks, but I can't remember personally seeing any, although a number of our ships were sunk. by air attack, but not while we were there. Although coming back, no, that was a bit later, I saw a ship mined, a merchant ship, called the Maid of Orleans, in which I had sailed over to Belgium before the war. And she struck this mine about half a mile from us, I should think. And she went down in lightning speed. And we picked up, I think, about four survivors.
Was that all there was, or did other ships?
Yeah. And I remember we picked up one of the cooks. And he had terribly burnt hands because he'd been in the galley. And when the mine struck, his hands went down on the cooker. And this chap, of course, he couldn't clamber up the side of the ship to get out of the water. Anyway, a couple of the sailors went over the side and got him up. But he was in a parlor state, and we didn't carry a doctor in these ships, but we had a sick berth attendant, a sort of a rating sickie boy, who was absolutely super. Because, of course, this chap was in tremendous pain. I jabbed him with morphia, first of all, when he got on board. All the officers had morphia ampoules, you know, for this sort of thing. But our sick berth attendant was absolutely marvellous. He probably had never met this sort of thing before, but he was absolutely calm as a cucumber. Splendid fellow. I wish I could remember his name, but he was very good for the morale of the ship. But otherwise, we didn't... we took a number of convoys and landing craft over there and left them there. But we did carry on one... one sort of clandestine operation round in Brittany, where we and two other destroyers, I think, went round with two landing craft to land some tanks behind the enemy lines near the little port of Lockyer, Lokuire, in Brittany. And we crept in by radar in fairly thick fog, and anchored about, 500-600 yards off the beach. And eventually, the fog cleared, and bright blue skies. And we suddenly saw two girls, stark naked, swimming out from the shore to the ship. This was the first warship they'd seen since 1938 or something. So they clambered up the side of the ship, and we gave them some towels and whatnot, and plenty of navy cocoa, and chatted them up, and sent them back ashore in our motorboat, still without any clothes on. But we thought this is the way to go to war. My wife and I, some years later, went to Lockyer when we were going around Brittany in our car. But we couldn't find the girls, and unfortunately it was a Sunday afternoon, and so the town hall was shut. But it would be amusing to have met those girls and said, do you remember that day in 1944?
And did you successfully land the tanks behind?
Oh, yes, they landed the tanks, oh yes.
With no opposition?
No trouble, no. No, it took the Huns by surprise. Yes, it was tanks and masses of canned petrol.